Chapter 10. I want 3 volunteers. You, you, and you. High above Pearl Harbor, the last raiders wheeled off to the west, vanishing as mysteriously as they had appeared. On the Nevada, Commander Thomas moved off the mud of Hospital Point and, with the aid of tugs, backed across the channel to the hard, sandy bottom of Waipio Peninsula. Word was passed releasing the men from battle stations, and musician C.S. Griffin began groping his way up from the third deck forward. When he finally stepped into the bright morning sun, he glanced at his watch. It said 10 a.m. For the first time, men realized what a strain it had been. Bosun's mate, K.V. Hendon, ran into one of his best friends who'd been working a 5-inch gun all morning. The man was so dazed he couldn't recognize anybody. All he could still see were planes. The men in the anti-aircraft gun shack passed cigarettes around, omitting as usual the clean-cut member of the team who, as far as they knew, didn't smoke or drink or even take coffee. Shakily, he said, "I think I'll have one of those." Ensign John Landreth emerged from the port anti-aircraft director, felt a curious numbness. Training and discipline had seen him through, but in the back of his mind the question kept revolving, what is this really? A dream, perhaps? Or is it really me shooting at other men and they shooting at me? What is this really? Perhaps indeed it was a dream, thought PFC John Fisher, a young MP at Fort Shafter. And when no one was looking, he even pinched himself, hoping he would wake up and find everything was all right. As Staff Sergeant Frank Allow surveyed Hickam's smoldering wreckage, he felt like a small boy looking at his dog lying in the road after it had been hit by a car. It was simply unbelievable that such a thing could have happened. But there was little time for reflection. A man had to think fast just to stay alive on the burning, sinking ships. When the Oglala finally rolled over on her port side at 10 o'clock, Admiral Furlong slid down toward the low side of her deck. He showed the timing of a trapeze artist hopping nimbly ashore as the side of the deck rolled flush with the edge of 1010 dock. Officially, it was said the Oglala's seams had been sprung by the torpedo that held the Helena. But there are men who still claim the old Fall River boat really sank from fright. Across the channel, it was time to abandon the West Virginia, too. Fires raged out of control around the conning tower and foremast, igniting the paintwork, trapping Lieutenant Ricketts and the others still on the bridge. Ensign Lombardi got a hose going, and a seaman played it on the little group. Then Ensign Hank Graham tossed up a line, and the men came down hand over hand to the deck. Ensign Delano was cut off from the rest. He finally crawled forward on the searchlight platform and used the turrets as a giant stepladder to reach the deck. He jumped overboard and swam for Ford Island, trying to keep ahead of the oil burning on the water. "Help, help, I can't swim any farther," called a familiar voice somewhere behind. It was an old chief petty officer, known to be a poor swimmer. Delano was now too weak to do any towing, but at least he could encourage the man. As he turned his head, the old chief thrashed by, arms and legs flying through the water, still yelling that he couldn't swim any longer. He reached shore 5 minutes before Delano. Ensign Jacoby plunged off the West Virginia's forecastle, still wearing shoes, uniform, and even cap. He swam under the burning oil, emerged beyond it, and headed for a launch from the Solace. But his waterlogged clothes dragged him down, and the burning oil crept over him faster than he could swim. A sailor in the launch dived in to help, apparently forgetting that he couldn't swim at all. They were rapidly drowning each other when someone else in the launch knotted some sheets together, tossed out the improvised line, and dragged them both in. It was close. As they were hauled aboard, the bow of the launch was already starting to burn. Ensign Vance Fowler, the West Virginia's dispersing officer, abandoned ship far more stylishly. He pushed off in a raft and moved swiftly to shore, using his cash ledger as a paddle. Seaman George Murphy had no use for a paddle, trapped in the dispensary of the overturned Oklahoma. He and some 30 others were in a triangular-shaped airspace with about a 3-foot ceiling. Carpenter John A. Austin had a flashlight, and they played it around, trying to figure out where they were. None of them yet understood that the ship had turned over, that the tile overhead was really the deck. For over an hour, they didn't even try to get out. They could cling to a combing around the tile without constant swimming, and it seemed best just to wait. They all assumed help was on the way, never dreaming they were far below the surface of Pearl Harbor. Time went on, and they began to wonder. Eventually, someone kicked a porthole under the water, and the men took turns ducking down and investigating it. They were still reluctant to dive through because many of the ship's portholes led only to void space, and nobody wanted to get trapped that way. Finally, there was no choice. The air grew foul, and it was clear they couldn't live in the compartment. One by one, they began squeezing through. It was a slow process. The porthole hung the wrong way. That's how they learned the ship was upside down. And every time anybody tried it, one man had to go underwater and hold it open for the other to escape. Nothing could help the man who first found the porthole. He was simply too big for the 14-inch opening. He bobbed back up, completely broken. Several others began shouting and calling out prayers. Seaman Murphy barely made it. He had to try 3 times before he finally squeezed through and kicked out from the ship. He popped to the surface and was picked up by a launch from the Dobbin shortly after 10 o'clock. The thing that really amazed him was not his escape, but the scene in the harbor. The men in the compartment had all assumed that the Oklahoma was the only ship damaged. There was no problem abandoning the California. As the burning oil drifted down the harbor, engulfing her stern, Captain Bunkley gave the order at 10:02 a.m., and the men swarmed ashore. But the wind blew the burning oil clear, and by 10:15, Captain Bunkley was trying to get everybody on board again to fight the fires. Yeoman Durrell Connor abandoned his efforts to evacuate some files and watched an officer appeal to the men on shore. He gave quite a pep talk, saying that the California was a good ship, and if they would all come back and fight the fire, he thought they could save her. The men seemed a little slow, and Connor had an inspiration. Noting the flag had not been raised, he grabbed a seaman, and together they hoisted the colors on the fantail. A big cheer went up, and men began streaming back. The upturned Utah was, of course, beyond hope, but the banging within her hull told Commander Isquith that he might at least save someone trapped inside. So he worked away with machinist Szymanski, who knew all about welding, water tender H.G. Nugent, who knew the structure of the ship's hull, and chief motor machinist Terence McSelwyny, who wanted so much to help. Strafers bothered them at first, but then the raid died down and cutting outfits arrived from the Raleigh and Tangier. They traced the noise to the dynamo room and went to work. After an hour, they had an 18-inch hole and yelled to whoever was inside to stand clear so they could pound the plating in. When they finished, out popped Fireman John Vason, who had kept the lights going until it was too late to get out. Unlike the men in the Oklahoma dispensary, Vason knew right away that the ship was upside down. He set out for the bottom with a flashlight and an open-end wrench for tapping signals. When he reached the double bottom, he had to undo 20 bolts to get through to the outer skin of the ship. Here he enjoyed a stroke of the incredible luck that sometimes helps a brave man in danger. His wrench just happened to fit the bolts. Down in the plotting room of the Nevada, Ensign Merdinger wasn't yet trapped, but his agile mind began thinking along those lines. The room was 5 decks down. The regular lights were out, and the emergency system cast a weird green glow. The ventilation was gone, and to save their breath, the men lay down, phones strapped to their heads. Some were stripped to the waist, others still wore their shirts. Merdinger noted the beads of sweat glistening in the pale green light, and thought what a dramatic movie it would make of men trapped in a submarine. His thoughts passed through various phases, taking the form of silent prayers. At first he hoped he wouldn't be wounded. As things grew worse, he hoped that, if wounded, he at least wouldn't be permanently crippled. Finally, he reached the point where he was completely prepared to give his life. He prayed only that he might die, and he knew he was guilty of a cliché, like an officer and a gentleman, an inspiration to his men. Certainly there was nothing to encourage him in the reports drifting down from above. The plotting room was a sort of clearinghouse for information, and all the news seemed bad. He heard about the Oklahoma, and the Nevada started to list. The Arizona blew up, and fire spread close to the Nevada's magazines. Every disaster on the other ships seemed to stalk his own. And now, to top it off, the bridge was calling for anyone who could speak Japanese. That suggested even more unpleasant possibilities. Topside, Ensign John Landreth heard the radio say the Japanese were landing on Diamond Head. Radioman Peter LaFata of the Swan picked up even worse news. They had taken Waikiki. The danger lay not to the east, but to the west, according to rumors heard by the Arizona survivors at the Navy receiving station. In fact, 40 Japanese transports were off Barbers Point. It was worse than that. They were already landing men at Waianae Beach, someone told Gunner's mate Ralph Carl on the Tennessee. Others claimed the Japanese were really landing to the north. At the Navy Yard, civilian worker James Spaniola heard that the entire North Shore was lost. At Schofield, Lieutenant Roy Foster got word that a major assault would be launched on Schofield and Wheeler within 30 minutes to an hour. Marine Sergeant Burdett Odekirk heard that Schofield had fallen. As if seaborne invasion wasn't enough, other reports spread that Japanese paratroopers were raining down from the skies. At Nanakuli Beach to the northwest,